John Rourke wore a white tropical weight dinner jacket and the kind of bow tie that was tied rather than clipped on. One could tell from the way the ends of the bow sagged slightly. He stood at the head of the stairs, his long legs spread slightly apart as though he had stopped in mid-stride, as though nature had somehow freeze-framed him there. The photograph, sent in the diplomatic pouch from Dzerzhinsky Square, hadn't done him justice. He'd been exiting the plane, the collar of a heavy coat turned up against a strong wind that had tousled his hair, the collar obscuring much of his face. And the photo had only been in black and white. Vladimir looked briefly into her eyes, then turned his head, craning his neck to stare toward the Miami Grand's main entrance, where the American case officer Rourke, Vladimir had determined, would be killed tonight. The water couldn't be drunk since the Revolutionary Guard had blown up the American-financed filtration plant. There was disease in the poorer parts of the capital, but Vladimir had told her it was a small price for Central America's poor to pay for equality and justice. And so, on business tonight, Natalia Anastasia Temerovna, Captain, Committee for State Security of the Soviet, sipped at Chablis Blanc instead, watching him over the rim of her tulip-shaped glass. It was the wrong shape for such wine. John Rourke stepped onto the club's floor. He moved with the grace of a black leopard, the surety of a stallion. She pushed a strand of her dyed blonde hair back from her forehead with the back of her left hand, glancing at the time on the plain lady's Rolex on her wrist, mentally logging it for her report. Rourke walked toward the bar.
It's him.
Vladimir Karamazov had spoken across his vodka tumbler. Unlike her husband, she never drank hard liquor while working. She nodded almost imperceptibly that she knew that this man was Rourke, John Thomas, case officer, United States Central Intelligence, Covert Operations Division, Central American Special Action Group.
Go up to the bar and refill your glass. Get a closer look. See if you can spot his gun. That might come in handy. He's right-handed.
All right, Vladimir.
She didn't bother to mention that had Vladimir read deeper into the file, he would have learned that Rourke was, for all intents and purposes, ambidextrous. So was she. The air was as heavy with smoke as it was with counterfeit American rock music as she drained off her glass and stood, catching up the skirt of her white ankle-length gown and starting toward the bar where the American leaned, at once casual yet somehow seeming uncomfortable. She knew his name, assumed his politics, knew why the CIA had sent him, but found herself wondering what he was really like. Natalia reached the bar.
Si. Another Chablis Blanc, please. It was house brand, I think.
Si. Anything for a beautiful woman such as yourself.
The bartender, a greasy-looking man in a white bolero-length jacket, smiled at her as he took the glass, his hand intentionally touching hers for an instant. She dismissed it, like accidentally touching a dirty doorknob. She glanced to her left, looking at this John Rourke. His forehead was high, but naturally so. His dark brown hair thick, healthy-looking. As if he felt her watching him, he inclined his head toward her, and before she averted her eyes, she saw his. They were brown, filled with steadiness and a hint of melancholy, and she felt a nervous feeling somewhere deep in the pit of her stomach. He was either very good at concealing a weapon, better than she would have thought he should be, or unarmed. She determined that as her eyes crossed over his body plane when the bartender brought her the glass of wine. There was no hint of a telltale bulge under his jacket, perhaps an ankle holster, the trouser legs wide enough for it if it were worn properly.
Gracias. Put the wine on our bill. Over there.
She walked straight back from the bar. Vladimir stood, but didn't get her chair. She sat down, raising her glass to her lips.
Either he isn't armed at all, or he's better than anyone I've seen at concealing. He could have an ankle holster, but I didn't see anything to indicate he did.
What did his file say?
He carries a .45 automatic, a Colt, sometimes two of them.
Any mention of a backup gun?
He carries a knife, an A.G. Russell Sting, it said, or sometimes a big Gerber.
Then we'll take him easily enough. You can see him better. Who's he talking to?
She lit a cigarette and looked across the flame of the lighter toward the bar. John Rourke was speaking with a Latin wearing a white dinner jacket, the Latin smoking a cigarette, holding it carelessly in his right hand, gesturing with it as he spoke. His name was Armando Fernandez Salazar, and he was head of the pro-American government's counter-terrorist unit, his identity a closely guarded state secret. Fernandez Salazar must have been in a back room, because she had not seen him at the bar before this instant. Fernandez Salazar did not know that his identity was known.
What's he doing, Natalia? I don't want to.
You're in luck tonight, Vladimir. Fernandez Salazar is standing at the bar with him. You can get both of... Wait.
What?
Rourke and Fernandez Salazar were walking around the end of the bar, a door opening quickly, both of them disappearing through the doorway.
They're leaving. It looked like a back room.
Merde.
Vladimir stood up, patting his pockets vigorously.
I left that other pack of cigarettes in the car, sweetheart. I'll be back in a flash.
She smiled as Vladimir left the room, heading toward the steps and the entrance. Natalia took her beaded bag from the table beside her cigarettes and lighter, using the mirror in the purse's flap to look toward the door beside the bar. It remained closed. She picked up her cigarettes and her lighter, starting to put them away. Cigarettes in the car meant that he was going to get the rest of the men. Sweetheart meant that she should follow the subject, in this case, subjects. Rourke and Fernandez Salazar. Flash meant they'd hit in 10 minutes. She had already ticked off 60 seconds mentally and glanced at her watch. At 11:14, Vladimir's people would come in, some through the main entrance and some through whatever back door presented itself. There would be a bloodbath unless she could get Rourke and Fernandez Salazar herself and defuse Vladimir's operation. Natalia stood up, tugging at her dress, letting it settle, turning her head toward the doorway through which Rourke and Fernandez Salazar had disappeared. She started toward the doorway, catching a glimpse of the bartender moving too quickly, his right hand snaking under his white jacket.
Señorita, it is prohibited.
She stopped less than a yard from the door. She looked at him. He came under the bar's drop leaf, his hand still under his jacket.
Oh, it's all right. I'm expected.
Señorita, is prohibited.
She shrugged her shoulders a little, making her cleavage deepen, his eyes widening, her left hand brushing against the left side of his torso. The gun she'd thought she'd spotted earlier was there. She started past him and stopped.
Señorita!
She had her dress up over her left knee, her right hand to the garter sheath and the balisong pressured against the inside of her left thigh. Her fingers closed over it as she let the skirt fall and turned toward him quickly.
Pero, señor, es muy importante.
She saw the sudden hardness in his eyes, the hand reaching for the gun. She stepped back quickly so the arterial blood wouldn't ruin her dress. The gun, a Walther P-38, fell to the ground. She reached down quickly and in one fluid motion had the gun in her tiny left fist. The balisong's blade wiped clean against the dying man's coat sleeve and was moving toward the door. She dropped the balisong down her cleavage, her purse under her left upper arm, her left hand shifting the 9mm to her right, then sweeping across the slide. She had never trusted loaded chamber indicators or the fact that a double-action pistol with a state-of-the-art safety system would be carried chamber-loaded.
Oh my God, he's dead!
She didn't have much time before panic overtook the nightclub.
Locked, of course.
She ran through the doorway, seeing Fernandez Salazar already turning around, another man wearing a black business suit and holding a riot shotgun wheeling toward her. There was no sign of John Rourke. She would have 5 or 6 rounds left, depending. The shotgunner's body rocked away as she wheeled toward Fernandez Salazar. He was drawing a revolver. She wouldn't let him. The first bullet went through his right wrist and he fell back, but he still tried to make his hand work enough to get the gun from under the left side of his coat, his formal shirt front splotching with blood from the first bullet's secondary wound. She aimed for center mass. It was important that he be dead. The Walther's slide was locked open. There had only been 7 rounds. The shotgun was too obvious. She tore Fernandez Salazar's hand away from the butt of the revolver and pulled it the rest of the way from the shoulder holster. It was a 4-inch nickel Colt Python, flashy, big, and macho-looking, just as she had expected. Her right hand was sticky with blood from the grips. There was no time to wipe it off. There was no time to check the load. The first man from the Miami Grand Bar came through the door, a Browning high power in both hands like some cop on American television. She had fired a double tap just in case the first chamber had been left empty. It was an old trick some police and security people used in case their revolvers were taken away and turned against them.
Rourke.
7 minutes before Vladimir would send in his people with the submachine guns. Perhaps the gunfire would have alerted him that it wasn't necessary, but that didn't stop the kinds of men he used. Tell them to kill, and they smiled. There was another doorway, and the .357 Magnum still had 4 shots. Her purse in her left hand, her fingers hitching up her dress so she could move quickly, Natalia ran the length of the yellow bulb lit corridor, eyes flickering side to side toward the doorways she passed. Performers' dressing rooms, perhaps. She could smell makeup. At the far end of the corridor was a door. She stepped back quickly, in case the American was waiting in the alley beyond. There was no gunfire, and she stepped through the shaft of yellow light and onto a small landing, flattening herself against the wall just beyond the door. She saw no one in the alley. Natalia started down the steps to the alley floor. She saw a flash of white moving toward her. The American in his white dinner jacket? Natalia stepped back into the shadows. Two of the thugs her husband hired were chasing after him. The American threw himself down behind a rank of trash cans. He rolled from cover for barely a moment. The second man charged toward him, and the American, Rourke, was on his feet. Rourke started running, coming toward her now, going for the fence that blocked her into the alley. Natalia dropped her purse, raising the python in both hands, tracking him as he ran until the range would make a miss impossible. He was coming into the cone of the alley light. He looked toward the doorway. Natalia saw his face. She lowered the revolver.
Thanks!
He ran past her to the fence, vaulting over it as if it were only 8 inches tall rather than 8 feet. He was gone.
Thanks. He said thanks.
Natalia's hospital gown was soaked with sweat. The first time she had seen John Rourke, her life had changed forever. The questions that had remained unspoken inside her about Vladimir and what he told her was right and good to do had become more nagging. She had always thought that stories of love at first sight were only for naive girls. And then she had learned that she was one. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna closed her eyes, wanting to see John's face again in her self-imposed darkness. But she could only see Vladimir's face, the look of horror in his eyes. The horror of recognizing the moment of his own death as her arms had arced John's massive knife toward his throat and steel first touched flesh and blood sprayed on her hands and face. Natalia opened her eyes, but she could still see Vladimir's face.
Horst, here!
Hans, have you found something?
Yeah, look.
At last, beneath the shelter of a scrub pine, where the drifting snow had not reached, Hans Weil had found a partial footprint, the portion of the sole impression matching perfectly to the design of Eden Project issue boots. Was it the man, Kuranami, or the black woman, Halverson? Japanese were smaller statured than Western men, and the foot size would be correspondingly smaller, he knew. He couldn't tell to which of the two they hunted the footprint belonged.
Horst, look here. A footprint. Dodd was right. They traveled toward Herr Dr. Rourke's retreat.
You had better call Dodd on the radio, I think.
Yeah.
Weil took the radio from the carrier on his vest. He telescoped the flexible antenna and pointed it southward.
Arrow 3 to Archer. Arrow 3 calling Archer. Come in, Archer. This is Arrow 3 calling Archer. Do you read me? Over.
Maybe we're too far.
Arrow 3, this is Archer. Reading you loud and clear. Over.
Archer, have located sign of prey near designated area. All is confirmed. Over.
Arrow 3, say again. Over.
Archer, have located some sign of prey. Indicates destination is designated area. All is confirmed as per your briefing. Over.
Arrow 3, contact Arrow 1, Arrow 2, and Arrow 4. The word is pearl. I say again. Pearl. Understood? Over.
The word is pearl. Understood. Over.
Archer out.
Arrow 3 out.
Weil switched frequencies, setting to the common frequency shared with arrows 1, 2, and 4. He studied his watch. In 10 minutes, it would be time for the regular call-up.
So, we go to this retreat, then?
Yeah. And we wait for Kuranami and Halverson. They have to come out sometime.
The doctor and his family stayed inside for 500 years.
Weil saw nothing funny in that at all, and he was very cold. Annie Rourke finished drying her hair and started brushing it. In the old movies on videotape that her father kept at the retreat, she would sometimes see women with such impossibly short haircuts. It would have to be easier to wash and care for, of course, but still.
What do you think about Michael in this deal with the Second City?
She still liked watching Paul shave, and as she looked into the vanity mirror, she could just see his image in the bathroom mirror, half his face still white and foamy with lather.
I don't know. It scares me. Those people are crazy from what I hear. I'd like to say they'd listen to reason, but...
No vibes on it?
No. No vibes.
Her psychic abilities, if that was what they were properly called, were telling her nothing, yet... But she had never really considered that precognition was something which really worked at all. She had her flashes while the event was actually transpiring, not before. If she ever started to see the future, she wondered if she would be able to handle it without losing her sanity. Just the thought of it made her shiver as she ran the brush through her waist-length brown hair. Her father had always told her it was honey blonde and that there were threads of gold in her hair, but to her it had always been just brown.
You sure you want to go back to Georgia with us?
Akira and Elaine are my friends, too. Mom will be all right here, and Maria's staying when Michael leaves. Once Natalia's out of the hospital, they can all keep each other company. We shouldn't be long anyway. I'm sure Commander Dodd is just a screw-up and doesn't have any insidious purposes or anything like that. Don't you think, Paul?
I don't know what to think.
He wasn't wearing anything but the bathrobe she had made for him. And his almost black, thinning hair was still wet from the shower, and the wetness made his head look shiny where there wasn't any hair. She thought it looked sexy, but never mentioned it because he was self-conscious about his thinning hair, and she was self-conscious about hurting his feelings. There was a tiny fleck of white soap on his neck. He usually shaved before he showered, but had told her he was so tired from the ordeal of the hospital that if he didn't run through the shower first, he'd fall asleep while he shaved. And they had to get back to be with her father and mother when the operation on Bjorn Rolvag was completed, so there wasn't any time to sleep. She hadn't liked the hospital either. She stood up and walked over to him, with her finger wiping the shaving cream off his neck.
Mrs. Spot?
Hmm?
Mm.
She rubbed the shaving cream off her finger and onto his nose.
Hey!
Zip me up.
I hate these things. There you go.
Thanks.
The laser surgery was scheduled to take at least another hour. They left their apartment in the government building and took the monorail back to the hospital. Paul was sitting beside her and holding both her hands in one of his. She didn't worry, somehow feeling that Rolvag would be fine. She had pondered why, when her father had been shot by the Russians in their underwater complex while he'd been trying to rescue Natalia and was near death, why she hadn't felt the danger reaching out to her, felt that he was in trouble. And she reasoned that perhaps she had felt it and been unable to sort out her feelings in so much danger herself then. Or was it that she hadn't listened to her feelings because they frightened her and on one level of her consciousness she had dismissed them? She would never understand this gift, as those who didn't have it called it. That it was more of a curse seemed obvious. By the time she really felt anything about his plight, he had been on his way back to Midwake for repairs to his surgery after the fight to the death with Karamazov. And then, too, she had just felt that he would be all right, like she felt now about Bjorn Rolvag. She made a mental note to go to the veterinary hospital and play with his dog for him before she left with Paul. Hrothgar would be lonely without his master. As the monorail neared the hospital, other feelings took hold of her, for Natalia. She sensed confusion, sorrow, despair. If she hadn't known better, she would have worried that Natalia wanted to take her own life.
Oh... Hold my hands tighter, Paul.
Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna sat cross-legged, her black canvas bag, it could be used as a purse or a small day pack, on the hospital bed before her. When the razor blade had been crafted for her to be hidden in her boot, she had ordered a second one, hidden inside her purse. She held the razor blade over her left wrist and stared at her vein. There was really no sense in living. If she died, John would grieve, remember her, but with the baby coming, the grief he felt for her death would be washed away by joy, his joy and Sarah's. Living only caused more grief for John. It was important to understand, despite what John espoused, that some situations were indeed hopeless, that sometimes there wasn't any choice left but giving up. She lay the razor blade against her skin. It felt warm to the touch. The warmth of her own hand from having held it for the last hour. Her eyes were fixed on the razor blade where it touched her flesh. One fast movement and a few brief moments of pain, and then a tired feeling and a warm sleep where there would be no dreams of loving John or killing Vladimir, and it would all be ended. She would miss dreaming about John. The tears stung her eyes, and she felt them roll down her cheeks, her tears seeming to her like acid burning her eyes and her flesh. And her soul. Michael Rourke, his gear packed and sent off with Hahn and Otto to the waiting German helicopter, stepped from the monorail, Maria Leuden beside him. Maria looked beautiful, he thought, wearing one of the Chinese-style dresses they called a chongsan. Michael Rourke was in full battle gear, his handmade double shoulder rig with the twin Berettas, the knife made for him by old Jan, the Icelandic bladesmith, the 4-inch Smith 629 in the holster at his hip. She looked up at him, her gray-green eyes half-shadowed by her lids, her eyelashes seeming impossibly long at the angle, like a long-ago memory of a butterfly folding its wings.
You look like you're on your way to a war, not a peace mission.
Peace through superior firepower.
Michael grinned and let Maria walk ahead of him through the pneumatic doors into the hospital lobby. His father, the battered old brown leather bomber jacket wide open, his guns would be under it, paced the floor, his mother standing beside the machine which dispensed hot Chinese tea in various flavors. Sometimes Michael found himself longing for the scenes he vaguely remembered from his youth, soft drink machines everywhere and real Coca-Cola that wasn't 5 centuries old like the few bottles left at the retreat.
Mom? Dad?
Michael. Maria.
Here, sit down.
They all sat. Biologically, as opposed to chronologically, Sarah Rourke was barely old enough to be an older sister. And Michael and his father, he was reminded once again, looked enough alike to be twin brothers.
Any word on Bjorn yet?
Nothing, but I suppose no news is probably good news in this case. You like some tea?
I can get it, Frau Rourke.
How about Natalia?
His father just shook his head.
Nothing has changed. She's resting. I think she's just really tired. And God help her, which she did. It's a miracle Natalia hasn't lost her sanity. All of us need a rest. And she needs it more than any of us. The tension of all this. Ugh.
Here you are.
Oh, thank you.
Sarah set her tea down and folded her hands in her lap with an air of helplessness. With her hands in her lap that way, the baby seemed suddenly noticeable. As a grown man, it was hard to accept the fact that he would soon have a new brother or sister. Dr. Munchen, or for that matter, the medical wizards of Midwake, could have determined the sex of the child, or even altered it to suit the desired sex with relative ease. Eye color, hair color, all could have been altered. But Sarah Rourke had insisted that she wanted to find out the old-fashioned way. Michael Rourke secretly felt that his mother and father's decision was probably best, but had said nothing. It was not his place to say.
Look, perhaps we should visit her.
Any word?
Annie and Paul had arrived.
Nothing yet, Annie.
Annie made the rounds of hugs and kisses, Paul a handshake here and there. Michael Rourke looked at his watch. There was nothing to do but wait, he supposed. The coordinates from the Eden computer pinpointed the location of Dr. Rourke's mountain retreat to within 100 yards. There was no mistaking the location from binocular range, Vial thought. A pinnacle of granite extending upward above the surrounding peaks. But even at highest magnification, there was no hint of an entrance.
As soon as the other teams are here, we will go up there. We will find the way inside. Oh, this Dr. Rourke is so very clever. But we shall see how clever, I think.
Vial let him talk. Horst had always displayed a propensity for talking before thinking. In the old days at the beer sessions after the party meetings, back at the youth rallies. Some things never changed. Vial stamped his feet against the cold, the binoculars moving slowly over what Dodd called Rourke's Mountain.
Comrade Colonel, we are past the coordinates you requested to be notified.
Thank you. Antonovich to ground control. Connect me with Major Prokopyev immediately.
This is Prokopyev. I await your instructions. Over.
Antonovich smiled. The man he had chosen to head up the newly reorganized elite corps was efficient. Whether or not he would prove to be too efficient remained to be seen.
Major, Plan Omega is activated. Necessary data will be transmitted immediately. Good luck, comrade. Out. Signalman, transmit the data.
He would keep his colonel's insignia for a while longer, despite the principal secretary calling him Marshal. He would wait, and he would see. Akira Kuranami entered the reserve arms locker. Rourke's personal weapons were encased in glass on the wall of the great room, and he would no more think of touching one of these without permission than touching another man's wife. But the reserve arms locker was another matter. Sleep would not come to him. He envied Elaine, soundly asleep on the guest room bed, and she looked beautiful in the borrowed nightgown. He imagined it was the property of Rourke's daughter Annie, who seemed the frilly type, despite her prowess with weapons and her cold logic. The reserve arms locker was a vault within the vault that formed the retreat itself. He recognized some of the long guns, collapsible stock Colt AR-15s, the civilian semi-auto versions of the M16 variant known as the XM77, the barrel only slightly longer, Steyr Mannlicher SSG sniper rifles. There were also a dozen M16s. Rourke had told him once that before the night of the war, he had not bothered with automatic weapons. The licensing provisions were intrusive of privacy, the licensing fees exorbitant, and the cost of the weapons themselves astronomical. And for some operating independently of an armed force and the sources of supply it would provide, automatic weapons invited ammunition over expenditure. But since the night of the war, Rourke had, on several occasions, liberated, as he put it, the selective fire versions of the Colt rifle. And as Kuranami's eyes traveled across the olive-drab metal boxes stacked along the floor beneath the rifle rack, ammunition supply was apparently no longer a potential problem. The Germans, of course. Rourke had gotten them to fabricate for him all the ammunition he needed in the calibers he favored, and hence required. 20 and 30-round magazines were crated beside the ammunition. He took six of these latter and one of the metal boxes of 5.56mm ball and one of the M16s from the rack, stacking the items neatly beside the door. There were various handguns, a blued version of the little Detonix 45s Rourke habitually carried, a half dozen of the Beretta 92F military 9mm Parabellums. He took one off the rack, the oil heavy on it, as it had been on the M16 when he'd touched it. The gun was marked as made in Italy, meaning it was from one of the early runs before production was shifted to the United States. He took several spare 15-round magazines and two of the 20-round magazines, setting gun and magazines beside the already stacked weapons. He set about finding 9mm Parabellum ammunition. 115-grain jacketed hollow points. This would, of course, duplicate the federal cartridge loads. Rourke, a man of definite tastes. He set the ammunition on the floor. A blade. Somehow, a blade was what he would take the greatest comfort from. And he found one. Knives marked Gerber and Cold Steel were suspended against a pegboard wall inset. He took down one in the classic conformation of a coffin-handled Bowie fighter. The handle was of some sort of black, checkered, rubber-like substance. The fittings brass, the steel gleamingly bright. It was marked Trailmaster. Rourke had explained to him once that each weapon he inventoried was logged in the PC on disk with pertinent information. Kuranami found a sheath that seemed right. It was black leather. Then, in several trips, took his borrowed weapons from the arms locker back into the great room. He secured the arms locker, washed the oil off his hands in the kitchen sink. He would worry about the oil in the kitchen counter later, and dried them. Kuranami went to the computer, several transparent lid plastic boxes beside it, each loaded with disks. He began to search through these, finding the disk marked FileMaster, then inserting it into the drive and punching it up. FileMaster was a key to the contents of the disks, and he found the one he wanted, weapons data. He changed disks and worked through the formatted file list, finding the right file and punching it up. The Beretta. It had been throated and checked with hollow points and shot to point of aim. The M16, like the Beretta, listed by serial number, was listed as functionally reliable but not the most accurate of the several M16s logged. The Trailmaster Bowie, a special type of high-carbon steel, it was not stainless, but according to Rourke's remarks, was admirably strong and sharp. Kuranami shut off the computer and replaced the disks in the proper slots in the boxes. He was wide awake still. He stood up, walked back to the kitchen counter, and set about finding what he needed to clean the guns. Dodd wanted him dead, that was obvious. Why? And as he began to field strip the Beretta, he remembered the face of one of the men who had tortured him, kidnapped Elaine, who would have killed them both. It was a face he had never seen before, neither among the Eden Project survivors nor among the German garrison. But whose face was it?
Old friend, I wish you could understand me.
They leaned over the Icelandic policeman, his eyelids fluttering. The operation was a success, or so they had been told. John Rourke had all the principals together in one room, and he used the moment.
Paul and Annie and I will go to Georgia and see about clearing up this business with Kuranami and Elaine Halverson. Michael, Don't take this mission to the second city too lightly. And remember that Han, despite the fact that he's your friend, as you told me yourself, owes the death of his family to the raiders from the second city. Men driven by revenge can view the world a little differently, as you well know. Remember the first thing you said to me when we met again after Karamazov was killed?
I said that you cheated me of doing it myself, but Natalia really did it. And I told her that I had wanted Karamazov's death more than I wanted anything, and now I'd never have it, and maybe I should thank her.
Remember your own emotions this trip when you try to interpret Han's emotions then. Now, Paul and Annie and I should be back in a few days. All of us have to be concerned with getting Natalia well, maybe getting her back to Iceland. She might be happier there, and she'd be farther away from her memories there.
You should spend some time with her before you go, John.
Mama's right, Father.
I know your mother's right, and I'm going to see her. Paul, you come too?
Of course.
John Rourke said nothing, but embraced his son tightly for a moment, then left the room, Paul following him.
I'm fine. Really, I am. I mean, the doctors are right. I should relax a little. Maybe focus my energies on something else. I'm really just fine.
Natalia's eyes were sparkling, but perhaps she had only just been crying, Paul Rubinstein thought. He stood a bit back from the two of them, watching. They were made for each other, Natalia Tyamarovna and John Rourke. He had said it often in the pages of the journal he kept, with intermittent but satisfactory regularity, even since the night of the war. He was reminded of the somewhat trite-sounding expression, star-crossed lovers, but indeed they were that. John held her hands in his.
Are you sure you're feeling better?
You know, Russians, depression comes and goes with us. I'm fine. I'd be a liar if I said everything was perfect and I was happy, but I'm all right, John. You take care of this thing with that crazy man Dodd accusing Akiro and Elaine. I only wish the doctors would release me so I could go too. But they want me here for another few days. I'll be out and around, and Sarah and Maria and I can see everything there is to see in the first city. You know the last time I shopped? 500 years ago. And I've got all the credit I want since these people insisted on rewarding us for stopping that train with the missiles. So see, what more could a woman ask? Unlimited funds, 2 friends to chatter with, and a whole city to explore and buy out. I want some of those dresses like Annie's been wearing. And you know, they even sell silk underwear here. I love silk underwear. So I'll be fine. Now, both of you, kiss me. None of this peck on the cheek kissing either, Paul.
Natalia held out her arms to him. Paul Rubinstein was suddenly afraid for her, and as he embraced her and softly kissed her lips, he felt a cold shiver deep within. He hugged her, stepped back. John leaned over the bed, drawing her close to him, holding her for a long time.
And don't you dare say it, John.
And then John Rohr kissed her, and Paul Rubinstein looked away. John Rourke, a light blue snap-front cowboy shirt half out of his Levi's, slung the double Alessi shoulder rig across his back, the twin stainless Detonics 45 Combat Masters chamber-loaded and secured. He stuffed the shirt tails the rest of the way down, beginning to thread his belt, the black leather sheath for the Grain Life Support System 10 going on his left side, then the Spark 6-pack loaded with 6-round Detonics magazines. He threaded the belt the rest of the way and cinched it closed. He secured the A.G. Russell Sting 1A black chrome knife in its spring clip sheath near the small of his back inside the waistband of his jeans. He secured his gun belt with the metal-lifed and magna-ported Colt Python 6-inch just below his trouser belt, the sheath for the grain knife going over it. Rourke picked up the 12-inch bladed knife, turning it in his hand. With this knife, Natalia had ended the life of Vladimir Karamazov. Although weapons were only instruments, he wondered if it better belonged in a museum for veneration by those who would no longer have to live in fear of the madman. But he sheathed it, because there were other evils in the world. Rourke took up his musette bag, slinging it cross-body from right shoulder to left hip, then skimmed into the battered brown leather bomber jacket. He patted the pockets and felt his immediate supply of cigars, his sunglasses, and his gloves. Rourke caught up the M16 and the second bag, this filled with magazines for the assault rifle. Like the knife and his other weapons, he knew that he would have a use for it. He gave a last glance at the empty apartment. Sarah would be waiting by the tunnel leading out of the city. He gave a last glance at the empty apartment and started for the doorway. The German helicopter's rotor blades began to turn more rapidly as John Rourke took Sarah in his arms.
I'll take care of Natalia.
Take care of yourself and the baby, for me.
He kissed her hard on the mouth, holding her close.
Everything's aboard, John!
Rourke looked at Sarah, her gray-green eyes, her auburn hair, her smile.
I really love you!
He kissed her again, quickly, then caught up his rifle and the low pack and broke into a run for the chopper, keeping his head low as he crossed beneath the whirring blades. He tossed the low pack through the doorway, then handed up his M16, Annie taking it. As he stepped aboard, he looked back. Sarah's left hand clutched gently at her abdomen and the life there, and her right hand waved toward him. John Rourke blew her a kiss, then slid the door home.
All secure, pilot.
Rourke eased back into one of the bench seats. There would be time enough to go forward and assume his duties as co-pilot. For now, as the helicopter lifted off, snow swirling cyclonically in its wake, he held his daughter's hand and watched the rapidly vanishing figure of his wife. Sarah still waved. Vasily Mikhailovich Prokopyev, Major, Commanding, Elite Corps, Committee for State Security of the Soviet, stepped to the open hatchway, the wind tearing at him, the jump light flashing to green. Prokopyev tapped the senior sergeant on the shoulder, the senior sergeant signaling the first man to jump. No static lines, high altitude, low opening. The light flickered amber, then green again. The next man jumping at the senior sergeant's signal, the flicker of the light again, then the green. The next man out, man after man, full battle gear in place. Prokopyev took his eye off the doorway and looked across the fuselage through the transparent panel in the starboard side door at the other two high-altitude capable silenced gunships disgorging their jumpers. The cargo chutes would open electronically when altimeter readings were proper. Prokopyev looked back to the jumpers on his own craft. One more, then the senior sergeant, then himself. The two lieutenants under him assigned one each to the jumpers with the other two gunships. He tugged at his equipment for the last time, all secure. The senior sergeant, Pyotr Yaroslav, glanced at him once, then jumped. Prokopyev stepping into the doorway, watching below as Yaroslav's image vanished into the darkness. Yaroslav. It was likely one of those names assumed during the violent days immediately before the 1917 revolution, then merely passed on. Green light. Prokopyev jumped. Somewhere to the north in the darkness surrounding him, the second Chinese city lay waiting.
Herr Doctor!
John Rourke took his eyes from the control panel he had been studying. Adolf Linz, the young German pilot of J-7V, was returning to the cockpit. Linz was tall, thin in the extreme, his face beneath the close-cropped blonde hair cheerful, however bony.
I am able to relieve you now, Herr Doctor. Thank you. It's a long flight.
Here you go.
Thank you.
But a good rest awaits you at the German facility outside Eden Base. Somehow that doesn't seem to cheer you, Lieutenant.
My wife, Olga, is in New Germany. Argentina, as you would call it, Herr Doctor. I have not seen her for 3 months.
Well, men have survived longer periods than that, but I hope you get to see her soon.
She is very pretty.
Yeah, I noticed the picture.
Rourke gestured toward the photograph wedged between the mounting frame and the landing gear control panel. She was blonde, trim-waisted, and almost classically large-bosomed, and undoubtedly much more pleasant to hold on a cold night than the controls of a J-7V VTOL fighter bomber.
Then you know what I mean. It will be good to rest at our facility near Eden Base, but it is not the same as being with my Olga.
Here.
Rourke took his wallet from his jacket, where he'd taken to carrying it since the awakening. It was wrapped in a waterproof plastic bag. He opened the bag, and from his wallet he extracted one of the laminated photographs.
Her name is Sarah.
He extended the picture in his hand, and Lieutenant Linz took it.
She is so pretty, your wife. Very beautiful. You are having a baby, I understand.
Well, Sarah is, actually.
The young fellow was apparently starved for conversation, or naturally curious, or perhaps both. Rourke took back the photograph of his wife, returning it to his wallet, returning the wallet to the bag, and then to his pocket.
She's through the first trimester.
You must be excited. Olga and I, we want children. If I speak out of turn, Herr Dr. Rourke, please tell me to be quiet. But your daughter in there?
Lynch gestured with a cock of the head toward the compartment just aft of the cockpit.
She's 28.
I have heard the story. I know I'm rude.
No, it's all right. Briefly, after we took the cryogenic sleep as the great conflagration began, I awoke early, then awakened my son Michael and my daughter Annie. I stayed with them for 5 years and returned to the sleep when I thought they were adequately prepared to function together on their own. I continued in the cryogenic sleep until Annie was nearing the end of her 27th year. The children had aged to adulthood, while I only aged 5 years, and my wife Sarah aged virtually not at all. The same held true of the man who's now her husband, Paul Rubinstein, and, of course, Major Tiamarovna.
Ah, she is pretty. Major Tiamarovna. I saw her. She has a face a man would die for, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
Vile felt suddenly oppressively warm and began removing his parka. In the night, outside, it had been bone-chillingly cold, the temperatures throughout the period of the last several days dropping almost imperceptibly at first, but now more than a man could bear at night. Would they continue to drop? He longed for the warmth of his native New Germany. But the spirit of the Reich had to be served, and participating in this Dodds conspiracy was the only available means by which this end could be accomplished. If the Japanese officer and the black woman with him had been unable to reach Rourke's mountain retreat, there would have been no need to worry over them. Without one of the hermetically sealed tents, they would have died, regardless of whatever survival training they had been given. Vile sat at the table now, the men from the other teams idling away the night playing cards, reading. Only Horst was still out in it, still scanning the mountain with his vision intensification binoculars, huddled as close as he could get to the field heater, searching for some secret and penetrable entrance into Rourke's mountain. Failing that Horst found such an entrance, there was the other alternative. Vile glanced toward the explosives stacked in the far corner of the tent. John Rourke saw to his gear, the low Alpine Systems loco pack secure, his leather jacket inside. Snowshoes or cross-country skis might have been useful, he thought, considering the weather. He pulled on the heavy gray woolen sweater, glancing at the Rolex on his left wrist. Nearly 9.
Paul?
All set, John. Just helping Annie with the boots.
Rourke found himself watching his daughter intently. It was odd seeing her in pants, but even with her decidedly feminine tastes, she hadn't said a word when they had discussed the return to Georgia, and he, Rourke, had cited German meteorological reports. The pre-dawn low here was anticipated to reach minus 20 degrees, the wind chill factor creating the effect of minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Regardless of clothing, however prepared they might be, it would be impossible to remain in these temperatures for long without retreat to some sort of shelter. For this, and a second reason, he had determined that once the J-7V landed, he and Annie and Paul would strike immediately for the retreat in order to reach shelter and to ascertain whether or not Kurenami and Elaine Halverson had reached there. If they had not, there was considerable likelihood they were dead by now. But he would find some means of making Annie stay behind in relative safety at the retreat and set out with Paul using the truck, looking for them anyway. The insulated snow pants already on, Rourke shouldered into his parka, almost instantly stifling in the warmth of the J-7V's fuselage.
Dr. Rourke, we will be touching down in precisely 5 minutes. Please prepare to secure for landing.
Rourke checked his pockets, the insulated toque there, the snow goggles as well, the insulated gloves on top of the pack.
All right. Paul, Annie?
Right, Daddy.
Annie slid onto the bench-like seat, strapping in, Paul beside her. Rourke shoved his pack into a safe corner and sat flanking Annie.
I hope we find him. And what's going on?
Michael Rourke reined back on the Asian horse under him, his eyes squinting against the full brightness of the sun, the stocky little gray bucking slightly, Michael knotting his fists into the coarse black of its mane, almost wrestling the animal into control.
You look like your father without his sunglasses, your eyes half closed against the sun like that.
Otto Hammerschmidt reined in beside Michael, having more apparent difficulty with his mount. The animal's hide ran from chestnut almost through black, with every shade between somewhere represented, glistening with sweat at the flanks.
We will be encountering the roving patrol soon.
Michael observed that Han Lu Chen was handling his horse better than either Hammerschmidt or himself. Michael wondered absently if it were just that Han knew better what to expect, and through anticipation, could counter the moves of the ill-tempered little creatures because of that. The other six men of the detail, three Chinese and three German, all enlisted personnel, formed a ragged semicircle around them.
Better break out the banner, then.
Agreed. Although it will have very little effect, I think.
Han swung out of the saddle easily, handing over his reins to Michael. The pack animal that one of the three Chinese soldiers had led at the rear of the column stood docilely enough as Han dug beneath the covering over the pack saddle and produced a neatly rolled length of silk, the backs of embroidered lettering visible here and there. From the side of the pack saddle, Han took a pole some 5 feet in length, one end of the pole semi-sharp. The ground was so hard that the pointed tip barely penetrated anything more than 2 or 3 inches. As if on cue, a gust of wind crossed the rock-strewn gray plain on which they had paused, the deeper, almost purplish gray of the mountains jutting savagely upward in the distance, the mountains white-capped with snow from the approximate midpoint of their elevation. The gust of wind caught up the banner, unfurling it as Han began to affix the top of the banner to the staff. They were Chinese characters, embroidered in a deep blue against the field of pearl-cast white silk. Michael Rourke could not read them, but knew their meaning nonetheless. The banner proclaimed that the riders came in peace, despite their weapons, in order to speak with the great leader of the Second City concerning a matter of grave importance. His indulgence was begged that they might be allowed to speak with him in an honorable fashion. And Michael Rourke was beginning to wonder if his father's implication that this was a fool's errand might not be true. In those mountains lurked the Mongol mercenaries who had been about to rape Maria Leuden and nearly caused Otto Hammerschmidt's death. Beside him, Otto's expression seemed to have deteriorated from serious to grim. Han handed the banner to one of the Chinese soldiers.
We ride to the base of the mountains, Han?
If we get that far, Captain Hammerschmidt.
The German-Chinese force continued toward the mountain, the banner calling for peace and diplomacy held high in the wind. Michael's right hand drifted to the saddle scabbard and the M16 there. The man they went to see called himself Mao after the iron-fisted totalitarian who ruled post-World War II communist China. As Michael Rourke's hand lingered on the butt of the M16, he recalled something Mao Zedong was credited with saying, "All power comes out of the barrel of a gun." Michael frowned. Mao's words made for sobering thoughts. The J-7V hovered over the ice-packed, wind-hardened snow crust. The cloud of falling snow from the growing blizzard and tiny specks of loose ice swirled so densely around the machine that visibility extended barely beyond the length of John Rourke's reach. His eyes were goggled, his face toked, his head hooded, his hands gloved, but still, the shock of cold penetrated almost to the bone as he reached out for Annie, Paul already having her by one arm. Rourke taking her by the other, both men leaning their bodies into the swirling snow and ice and wind. Rourke dragged his daughter ahead, Paul pushing her forward. He looked upward, his goggles almost instantly covered with a thin coating of snow and ice. He just barely made out the shape of the J-7V as it banked away. Rourke gathered his daughter in his arms, further attempts at movement pointless until the aircraft's cyclonic downdraft was abated. Paul's hands protected her face and head. Rourke embraced her closely. It had been a mistake to bring her here, but a mistake she had pushed for, beyond volunteering, insisted upon. They had been exposed for less than a minute, and bitterly, Rourke thought, if Kuranami and Halverson were out in this, they would be dead.
We have to get moving! Annie, will you be all right?
If everyone stops suffocating me by trying to protect me...
He touched his covered-over lips to the hood of her parka and let her go.
We have to get inside and out of this wind!
Rourke nodded vigorously, not only for argument's sake, but that his gesture be understood. He had shot a last-minute azimuth on his compass before the aircraft had touched down, and he oriented himself now toward the ground.
Follow me!
It was the wind howling at gale force which heightened the cold, made it penetrate despite the heaviest of outer garments. And his plotted course would soon take them into a defile. They would have to labor along its sides because of the depth of the snow. It was impossible to tell exactly how high because of the downdraft of the machine, but in the defile they would be out of the wind. Paul began feeding out rope, Rourke using a carabiner clip to secure the leading end to his equipment. Annie was 6 feet down its length and between them. Then Paul clamped on, the remainder of the climbing rope coiled over his right shoulder. Already John Rourke was moving, his body leaning into the wind. He hoped, shielding even marginally the effect of the wind on his daughter. He kept moving.
There it is! Inside! Follow me!
They stumbled and slipped and finally reached the defile, trudging forward to get Annie and then Paul into its protection.
All right, I'm coming down. Everybody okay?
Yeah, as long as we stay in here.
Well, we won't be here forever.
That was what I was afraid of.
Men in white snow smocks, he assumed they were men, moved like spiders, their web a network of climbing ropes taking them along the face of the mountain which housed the retreat rather than along the roadbed. One man would founder in the snow, be lost momentarily from sight, then appear, the others seeming almost to drag him onward for a time, then another man would endure the same. But through it all, they kept going. Slung over the white snow smocks were M16 rifles and backpacks and carryalls and other gear. John Rourke brought the binoculars down from his eyes and quickly drew his goggles back to protect his already numbing skin.
What the hell are they doing?
Assaulting the retreat, it appears.
Why? And who are they? From Eden?
Evidently. Akiro and Elaine are inside the retreat, or at least our friends out there think they are. In either case, unless they're total imbeciles, they must be planning to plant explosive charges where they think the main entrance is. Aside from ourselves, only Kuranami and Halverson know the secret of the entrance. It seems safe to assume that if either of them had been captured, the secret of the entrance could have been extracted. Now, if both of them had been captured, there'd be no reason to penetrate the retreat. Logic indicates they're both inside and that whoever sent these men knows it.
Could conventional explosives do anything?
If the right kind of explosives were used and whoever planted them or instructed them to be planted had some engineering and geology skills to back him up, unfortunately so, yeah. Probably more damage than they think. I built a retreat to withstand everything except a direct hit, selected the site accordingly, but no location is completely insusceptible to explosive damage if the job is done correctly.
Shit.
Indeed.
Then what will we do?
Rourke didn't answer her, but pulled down his goggles as the skies had caught fire, almost as if they knew. Rourke licked his lips beneath the covering of his toque. He looked at his daughter and his best friend, her husband.
Somehow, I think they know about the escape tunnels, or at least the one which leads out onto the top of the mountain. I can't begin to fathom how they could, but it's the only logical conclusion. They're hauling explosives to the top of the mountain to blow their way in through the escape tunnel.
Could we have said something?
No, anything we said wouldn't have betrayed the exact location. If they plant explosives all over the top of the mountain, that won't help them inside. They have to crack the double doors, otherwise they'd just be burying the tunnel entrance. Somehow, they know, it appears. So,
what do we do?
Even if Kuranami has the retreat secured from inside, and I didn't show him how, he'll become aware of someone trying to enter. So you can get inside without him letting you in, or he'll let you in. Either way.
What are you doing?
I'm going up around the backside to the top of the mountain. I'll beat them by a good 10 to 15 minutes if I leave right away and they continue at their present rate of ascent. The two of you get to the main entrance and get inside, then secure the retreat, Paul. I don't want anyone getting in through the front door just in case they know about that. Then, Paul, you and Annie set up by the base of the tunnel leading to the top of the mountain. M16s in a crossfire ought to do the trick in case they get past me.
Suggestion?
Suggestion.
You and Paul take the back way around. I can get to the main entrance myself and I can get inside. I've done it before when I've had to. If Akiro and Elaine are inside, the three of us can keep guard at the base of the escape tunnel. With you and Paul going up top, there's less chance they'll ever make it through. And it doesn't take any great skills to put that escape tunnel entrance in a crossfire inside if we have to.
You're smart, you know that. Paul, you game?
Well, that's a silly question, John.
All right, be careful, Annie. Go straight down there, and if there's the slightest sign of any more of these guys, you hide out until it's over, understand?
If I were Michael, you wouldn't say that.
You're right, chiefly because he might not have sense enough to listen. Now take off, sweetheart.
Be safe.
I will.
She started along the defile, wading through drifts that were waist high on her, her M16 held high in both hands over her head.
All right, Paul. Ready?
Yeah.
Rourke was up and moving, along the width of the defile and starting up into the higher rocks. He glanced back once along the defile, but Annie was already through the narrow pass at the base and had disappeared.
This is Vile. We rest for a moment. Secure your positions.
He anchored his harness to the climbing rope, sagging back into a depression of rock where the snow was only partially drifted, and he could, for a moment at least, escape the icy howling of the wind. His ears rang with it, and what little there was of his exposed flesh was numb. Horst's vigil overlooking Rourke's Mountain had yielded an interestingly promising result. Infrared emissions had indicated a marked difference in density at several locations along the mountain, beyond what Horst, a geologist by training, had considered normal. The story of Rourke on the last day before the ionization of the atmosphere had taken hold and the sky had caught fire was known to all by now. That he had used an escape tunnel and gone to the top of the mountain, and from there, single-handedly, armed only with the little pistols he perennially carried, combated the last Soviet helicopter. One of the anomalies Horst had detected was at the very crown of the mountain itself, and, if they had any luck, the tunnel spoken of in the story. Explosives such as they carried would crack through any artificial entranceway, and then they would be able to penetrate the tunnel itself, utilizing more explosives at the base, because doubtless there was an interior door, and then the gas. The Japanese and his black mistress were too dangerous to be allowed to live. There was always the threat that Rourke would, for some reason or another, return to his retreat. Rourke or one of his armed and dangerous children, or the Russian woman Rourke was so fond of. Vile discounted any true danger. Even if Rourke and three or four of his family were to return, they would be hopelessly outnumbered. Vile looked to his weapon instinctively. The American M16 was primitive, but satisfactory, although he would have preferred a weapon of German design, even one of similar vintage as these 5 centuries-old museum pieces, perhaps the Heckler & Koch G3. He had seen these in museums at New Germany, though never fired one. They appeared more substantial and, according to the data he had read on them, used a more substantial cartridge as well. Vile mentally shrugged. The rockets he and his men carried would more than compensate for any shortcomings of their firearms, more than take care of this almost mythically endowed American, John Rourke. And then, work could progress to advance the cause of Nazism. The snow made the going slower than Rourke had anticipated, so he quickened his pace against it, taking into account the toll the exertion would take on him. He didn't want to fatigue himself or Paul Rubinstein to the extent that they would be too exhausted to fight when they reached the top of the mountain. But it was imperative to attain the summit before the 8 men with explosives reached it.
Hurry, Paul!
Right behind you!
It was necessary to raise his knees almost to the height of his waist in order to wade through the drifts, and the snow was very wet, uncharacteristic for Georgia at an earlier period, to his recollection, and so its very heaviness weighed against him. But John Rourke kept moving. Annie Rourke fought through the drift, since there was no way of getting over or around it. Her arms too tired to keep the rifle anything more than chest height, the snow almost to her waist. It was necessary to plunge into it, then lift the legs as high as they would go, then plunge forward, compacting snow beneath the feet, only to lift again and move perhaps 2 feet forward, then repeat the process. But ahead, she could see the entrance to the retreat. It was coming home for her, the only real home she had known since she was a little girl. The difference in ages between herself and her brother were nothing now, but his memories of the incidents before the great conflagration were more detailed because he was 2 years older. And she didn't envy those memories, the time between the night of the war and when the skies caught fire and all seemed ended, and they took the sleep as a last desperate gamble. It was hard for her to recall that interim period and the few years of normal childhood in anything more than generalities. Annie Rourke Rubinstein could envision the Mulliner's dog and the farm field where, Michael told her, they used to run and play. But how much of that vision was recollection and how much suggestion? There were isolated, vivid memories of the house where they had lived before the night of the war. Memories of her mother's studio and the paintings that became the illustrations used in the children's books Sarah Rourke had created. Memories of warm smells in the kitchen, bread baking, cookies fresh from the oven. But the other memories, the fear, the running, the hiding, the killing, she envied Michael not at all. She stopped before the entrance to the retreat and pushed back the hood of her parka, pulled down her goggles, undid the woolen scarf tied over her head, tore the toque away, her hair caught up in the wind, her face and throat and ears instantly as cold as ice, tingling. But if Akiro and Elaine were monitoring the entrance, they would recognize her that way. If not, she would attempt to open the door herself. If somehow Akiro had secured the entrance and she was not noticed, she would return to the rocks and wait in what shelter they would afford. Already her skin was numbing. She would give it another 2 minutes before beginning to re-don her headgear. If she could last that long.